At FDD, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, we're concerned about, well, some might say we're obsessed with, the most threatened free nations. There are four at the top of our list: Taiwan, South Korea, Israel, and Ukraine. The latter two are fighting multi-year wars, Ukraine to prevent subjugation, Israel to prevent extermination. Our concern for these endangered democratic societies requires that we also focus on their enemies, Beijing, Pyongyang, Tehran, and Moscow, what we call the axis of aggressors. On Russia's war against Ukraine, there's no one from whom I learn more than Mark Galeazzi, a British historian, political scientist, and author, and host of In Moscow's Shadows, an invaluable podcast. I'm looking forward to speaking with him today. I'm pleased you're joining us here, too, in Foreign Podicy. Mark, Professor Galeazzi, how would you like to be addressed?
Mark, I think we'll do absolutely fine. I'm delighted to be here, and I appreciate the invitation.
Look, there's much in the news to discuss, but let's take our time. Unlike radio and TV, podcasts don't have a hard stop at the bottom of the hour. Start with this. How did you get into this racket? I mean, you've got a posh accent and an Italian name, so why aren't you lecturing on Alfred the Great or Machiavelli?
Yeah, I mean, particularly the Italian dimension, because I'm half Italian. My father was Italian. And incidentally, the name Galeotti, I mean, actually, it means galley slaves.
Oh.
Or in modern Italian, it actually means convicts, which probably explains why I'm also fascinated with transnational crime. No, I mean, look, if I had any common sense about me at all, I would have become an Italian specialist. Because I learned the language, but at the same time, I learned my English as a kid. And the food and the environment's much better. And I wouldn't be banned the way I have been banned from Russia since 2022. No, I have no good answer to why I'm so, frankly, obsessed with this country, except that, look, I'm a historian of the old school. I'm interested in the stories. And for me, Russia has always had the best stories, not the happiest stories, it has to be said. But even then, amidst all the blood and darkness, those glimmers of hope, of heroism, of optimism shine all the more brightly. So essentially, as long as I can remember, I have been sort of fascinated with this. The first time I went to what was then the Soviet Union was in 1980, just around the time when it was hosting the Olympics. Mm. And I have never looked back, even though at times there are I really think I should have.
You might find it interesting. I first went to the Soviet Union as a teenager in 1969.
And well, you definitely have beaten me there.
I beat you. Well, I'm a bit older than you. And I went back as an exchange student at Leningrad State University in 1972. Leningradsky Государственный Университет. And that time, Putin was there as well around that time, though not in the same field faculty, not in the same faculty as I was.
No, I mean, but you really are missing a trick, though, if you don't sort of parlay that into when I was at university with Putin, because after all, he's not going to.
What people do say, well, did you know him then? And my joke is, I say, well, you know, I got drunk on bad vodka with a lot of guys named Vladimir, so it's entirely possible. That's the best I can do. Tell me this. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, were you optimistic about what would happen with Russia?
I mean, it's a difficult one. I mean, in broad terms, yes, in the sense of there was a window of opportunity, which there was. I mean, I think this is the thing. Russia's history, it's very easy to think that Russia's doomed forever to misery and autocracy. Because on the whole, that's what it's had. But, you know, obviously past is not necessarily a predictor of the future. But at the same time, it very quickly became very clear just how grim the 1990s were for the overwhelming majority of Russians. You know, this is a time when Mercedes was selling more bulletproof limos into Russia than in the rest of the world put together. And you'd see the new rich in their brand new limos, you know, rolling through the newly neon lit streets of Moscow, while pensioners were lined up outside metro stations selling anything they had because their pensions were essentially sort of meaningless. And even at that time, there was that thought of, this does not have the vibe of something that looks as if it's going to turn out well. And I think this is the problem. We saw a situation in which, you know, Boris Yeltsin, the first president, he was a wonderful destroyer. When he had a target, the Communist Party, Gorbachev, he was focused, ruthless, and effective. But he was also, when it comes down to it, an old school party boss from the Urals. He had no vision of what a democratic Russia should look like. I mean, I'm willing to believe that he genuinely wanted a prosperous democratic Russia. You know, at the moment, particularly in the Russian media, there's so much demonizing him for him. But he just didn't have a clue. And frankly, so many wrong turns were made that very quickly it was clear that this wasn't going to work out well.
And how about Putin when he came into power? How did you initially see him? There were a lot of people. I remember, you know, President Bush saying, you know, I looked into his eyes and got a glimpse of his soul. And this idea that he was trustworthy. Did you early on think, wait a minute, like McCain did, this is a KGB thug. This is not going to work out well.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, you mentioned Leningrad State University. Actually, what struck me at the time was quite a lot of people I knew who came from what was Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, who tended to be in the liberal set. They were actually quite pleased. They convinced that Putin was kind of on their side. No, he wasn't a liberal, but they thought that ultimately his instincts were those that they could work with. And again, that really showed us that if Putin is able to do one thing, it's precisely to manipulate people. That's his, I would say, his one and only real talent. No, I mean, I thought that Putin, the best that I hoped for from Putin was that this was a man who was necessary for the time. But Russia was facing the potential of actual, you know, collapse as a nation, which would have been very messy, very bloody. So there was a need for someone who could actually bring the state back in. The question is, then what do you do with that state? And that was where my concerns were. So, you know, my hope was that this was a man who'd have a limited tenure, who would, you know, bring back the state, but that then others who had, shall we say, better instincts would then be able to sort of take over. The trouble is, it didn't happen that way.
Well, do you think that he changed over time in power? Evolved, or was he the same? Is he now the same person he was when he came into power?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. I think there's two points there. One is, does the circumstances change? You know, you respond to the challenges put upon you. But the second thing is, we can't ignore the warping, distorting effect of being 25 years pretty much the, you know, unquestioned monarch of your country. You know, frankly. Put Mother Teresa in that position and you'd probably get some kind of brutal, thuggish autocrat who would force us to be good at the end of it. So, look, I mean, I think Putin has changed, but in the sense of he's become more and more of a caricature of himself. So many of the sort of the worst characteristics have just become more and more pronounced over time. But also, look, he came in at what were in some ways the ideal circumstances. Everyone, frankly, wanted him to succeed, at least in terms of halting the collapse of Russia. The United States was very quickly going to become, you know, obsessed with the post 9/11 global war on terror that in some ways eclipsed everything else and allowed him to, for a while, even play his brutal war in Chechnya as if it was just his front on the global war. And he had a decade of high oil and gas prices. So he had a lot of money. So basically, he had the money to throw at everything. He could start rebuilding Russia's collapsed military. He could allow his friends and cronies to embezzle on an industrial scale. And there was enough left over for ordinary Russians to actually get a taste of a good life they had never had. The 1990s had been terrible. Suddenly the 2000s, the time when, you know, they didn't have to buy a larder. They could buy a secondhand Renault. They could buy a fridge freezer. They could buy a little apartment. You know, the ordinary basic things that make you feel confident and optimistic and think that your kids are going to have a better life than you, which is what really matters. You know, that was all there. So he had this extraordinary, I would say, decade of opportunity that in hindsight, it's clear that he absolutely squandered. He just kind of rode on that. But the point is, in some ways, it meant that for that decade, he didn't really have tough decisions to make. He had tactically tough decisions, but strategically, everything was going his way without him having to do anything. It's later that he's had the tough decisions, and we've seen that his instincts often are to do the worst possible thing when he's faced with those decisions.
Let me just try out two theories on you. one sort of geopolitical and one sort of psychological, which I shouldn't do, but I will. And the geopolitical is that Russia has never been, and in Putin's view, cannot be simply a nation state. It must be an empire. And that's one of the lessons of Chechnya. Chechnya is, after all, a colony, I would argue. Again, I'm happy to have you argue with me, and that its independence movement had to be absolutely crushed. And Russia became an empire by foot rather than by ship, you know, taking over Tatarstan. What is Tatarstan? Is not Russia. It's the land of the Tatars. Keep on going. A lot of small minorities as you go east. Now, couple that with, as one gets older, here's the psychological part, one thinks, what's my mission? What's my legacy? How am I going to be remembered? And it seems to me that at some point he thought, look, he's among the richest men in the world. He can kill people with impunity and does so. What else do you want? Well, again, a legacy. What should be my legacy? I'm kind of the czar. And the czar has a mission. The mission of the czar is in good times to expand the Russian Empire and in bad times to restore the Russian Empire. And that's the mission he is on now and will be, I think, for the remainder of his life. Am I going too far with that?
No, I mean, I'm glad it's a 5-hour podcast, so we really get grips with all the detail here. No, I mean, I think those are actually two entirely complementary theories that I think work very well. Let's kind of flip them around and start with the psychological, because yes, you know, on one level, we should never be amateur psychologists, but particularly when you're dealing with such a personalistic regime as this, actually, things do depend on whether he wakes up in the morning after a particularly bad night. Everything does depend on this one guy. So yes, I remember talking to a friend of mine who's a historian at Moscow State University. Now, the Russian system has awards and medals for academics, which is incidentally a system which I think is entirely laudable and more countries should adopt. On the whole, when it's a presidential award, Putin doesn't bother doing it himself. He staffs it out. He's a busy man. Historians, he will tend to actually do it himself. And apparently, almost invariably, when he's meeting historians, he will ask them the same question. In 100 years' time, how will they be writing about me? Now, point one, what a deeply uncomfortable question to be asked precisely by a man who can have people killed with impunity. But I think it also does exactly give us a sense of where his head is at. I mean, even just this bizarre, again, as a historian, it so bugs me that he clearly thinks of himself as a historian when he's such a bad historian. You know, if one thinks of his, you know, that extraordinary, surreal 30-minute opening to his famous or infamous interview with Tucker Carlson, where he decided that, in fact, the best thing was to provide a potted history as he saw it of all of Russian history. Well, you know, if that had been a paper that a student had given me, that would get a very bad grade because it was just so nakedly cherry-picked. You know, this was not the facts leading the story. This was the story leading the facts. Mm. So he has this notion that there is a grand destiny to Russia. That is, as you say, imperial rather than just simply national. And himself, he's concerned clearly with his personal legacy. And that really matters. And I think particularly when it comes to Ukraine, you know, I think he sees himself going back to Ivan the Great, who was famous, you know, one of the early pre-Tsar great
grandfathers. Or Ivan the Terrible.
Even before him, but Ivan the Great was known for the gathering of the Russian lands.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's precisely what Putin thinks of himself. You know, Belarus is already now pretty much a vassal state. And Ukraine, well, Ukraine could not be allowed to wrench itself from Russia's sphere of influence. That would absolutely be, you know, essentially that would be the defining feature of his tsardom, as it were, from the historian's point of view. Quite the opposite. It had to be brought all the more tightly back in. So, you know, from his point of view, bringing Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia together under Moscow's control would be, I would suggest, and, you know, who knows, I'm speculating here, but, you know, the kind of capstone of his career. But then to link it also to this business of empire, what I find fascinating is we can see, and maybe I'm just being willfully optimistic here, but a shift in attitudes amongst Russians. Putin is, after all, from the last true Homo Sovieticus generation, people who are not just educated, but had their formative early career experiences in Soviet times, who really haven't been able to cope with the idea of losing a superpower. And that has metastasized from how did it all go wrong to who did it to us? Who exploited us and undermined us and so forth? There is a real bile, a real vitriol to how Putin talks about how the West treated Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He blames us for everything that went wrong. So I think there is a kind of combination of things. On the one hand, unlike most Russians, frankly, would be delighted to see Chechnya go. They regard Chechnya as essentially, you know, a haven of jihadists and bandits for whom Moscow has to pay through the nose to keep happy. Frankly, if Chechnya went, I think Russians would be having parties. But, you know, obviously from Putin's point of view, as for Yeltsin before him, there was that sense of, no, you can't let anything go. And even, you know, I can't say that I spent much time in Tatarstan, but, you know, you don't really get the sense that these are people who feel themselves, on the whole, oppressed by an empire. You know, generations of colonization, of rule and so forth has created a certain kind of common identity. Now, whether or not the Russian Federation could survive in its current format, except for the North Caucasus in the future, who knows? But I do think that, in this respect, Putin is a bit of a man out of time. He is desperate to hold on to something that most Russians don't care about.
Two points here. One is, to be a czar, a reasonable translation, your Russian's better than mine, is czar of all the Russias. And all the Russias means Belarus and Ukraine, right? Belarus is White Russia, Ukraine is frontier Russia, I think would be as good a translation as I can come up with. But he's also made progress. This is not as well known, but in terms of taking Georgia back into his orbit, both by taking Abkhazia and South Ossetia to territories from it in 2008, and the Dream Party, that's the ruling party, is pretty much, as I'm seeing it, subservient to him, I would say. So he's pulling Georgia back in, and he's certainly intervening aggressively in Moldova, another former Soviet republic, with this strip to the east between Ukraine and Moldova, Transnistria, essentially being another little colony of Russia at this point. Do I have all that right?
Yeah. All I would say is, in some ways, I think of this almost as concentric circles. I mean, I think absolutely Belarus, Ukraine, or maybe even just simply eastern Ukraine, you know, he sees western Ukraine as basically a bit of Poland that somehow went astray. But exactly, these are the Russias, absolutely, and that's the kind of the imperial core. Places like Georgia, I don't think that there's any real appetite to conquer them. It's more about sphere of influence. Putin is a very 19th century geopolitician who essentially thinks that a great power is defined not just by its actual territorial extents, but by having, you know, an informal empire of countries that recognize who's boss, and in some ways that Moscow has the veto. On what, because in part that's how he, because after all, he's very, you know, subtle in some ways, very unsophisticated in others. I mean, that's how he sees the United States and Europe. You know, he essentially thinks that Europe is sometimes fractious, but essentially America's Warsaw Pact. That essentially America tells them what to do. And at the moment, Donald Trump is giving him rather more ammunition for actually believing that. But so I think from his point of view, there is this sense that, you know, countries like Georgia, it just simply, he wants to be sure that they know ultimately under whose umbrella they rest. Moldova, likewise. And there is a malice to his policy in the sense of, if he can't have it, no one should have it. I mean, Moldova, I don't think he genuinely thinks that he can actually exert meaningful control over the Moldovan government anymore. But it's more that he just thinks, well, okay, what I can be is very, very disruptive and essentially make Moldova pretty much unmanageable. So I think there is this sense of, you're with us or we'll just trash what you've got.
Now, the Baltic states are interesting here because they were Soviet republics. The U.S. never recognized that status from 1940 to 1991. They're independent now. They're all nervous now. I know all the ambassadors here in Washington, so I can tell you that. And among other things, just as Putin decided he had to have Crimea, okay, in 2014, I get that. Then he needs a land bridge, which He has essentially established through warfare at this point to Crimea. Might he not want a land bridge to Kaliningrad, which was part of Prussia and a sort of prize the Soviets took at the end of World War II, but it's not contiguous. To have a land bridge, you'd have to go through southern Lithuania or northern Poland to have that land bridge. And that's an interesting thing to consider, because that would mean triggering Article 5 of NATO. A war against one is a war against all. But are NATO members really going to fight for a road through southern Lithuania? Are Americans really going to be dispatched, paratroopers landing, for a road in southern Lithuania? I think that's maybe a hard case if you're a president, I don't know, Vance, or President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or whoever.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And this is always the problem, frankly, because it's deterrence, after all, depends on credibility. And so it's not just, would other countries fight for southern Lithuania? It's, does Putin believe other countries would fight? Because if he doesn't believe it, then there's no deterrence factor, even if in practice everyone would indeed pile in. And the trouble is, Article 5, it has this totemic power as, oh, it's a, you know, an attack on one is an attack on all. It's actually a very woolly clause. It just simply says that alliance members will respond appropriately. And that could mean an armored brigade, or it could mean a very stiffly worded letter to the Russian foreign ministry. And I think that's what particularly worries the Balts. I think the interesting thing here is that there's two separate issues. I don't honestly think for a moment that Putin has sent any sense that the Baltic states are sort of rightfully Russian. Again, I think most Soviets as well, they did see the Balts as being somehow separate. That's different from the potential geopolitical value of having a land bridge to Kaliningrad. So, you know, again, this is, shall we say, this would be an issue of head rather than heart, shall we say. And in that context, I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I'm still of the view that if there's going to be a threat, it's only going to be after full reconstitution of the Russian military, and that would take about 8 years from the end of the war in Ukraine. And in that time, after all, NATO is also now spending a lot more than it was. I mean, belatedly in the case of Europe, or much of Europe anyway. But, you know, NATO will be in a much stronger position. This is precisely, I think, why, although I don't actually think Putin would try anything in the Baltic states, precisely because of the risk. I think Putin is actually surprisingly risk averse. Remember, he went into Ukraine not believing he was going into a major war. He thought it was going to be a pushover. However, first of all, it is entirely conceivable that I'm wrong. One has to work on the kind of worst case scenarios. And secondly, in some ways, what actually scares me is not Putin. It's post-Putin. You know, if Putin dies, let's say the Ukraine war ends in some ugly way in the next 12 months. And Putin will be committed to rebuilding the Russian military at that stage. And he'll be continuing to pour money in and so forth. And then let's say he dies a year after that. Now, my hunch is actually that what we would get would be some kind of venal, self-interested kleptocrat who probably would actually quite like to improve relations with the West, because after all, that's better for the economy. The more the economy grows, the more you can steal, and you can enjoy all the perks of interaction with the West. But it is conceivable that actually what we'd get is a younger, smarter, nationalist hawk. Putin, as I say, I think is actually quite risk averse for all the macho posturing. But what if it's someone who wasn't? What if it's someone who definitely thought he had the measure of NATO, and that precisely when it came down to it, all he'd be facing would be, you know, a few NATO elements that are in the Baltic states now, and the Baltic war machines, especially if he can keep Poland out of it, given that Poland is arming at an extraordinary rate. Now, in those circumstances, that's when deterrence will really matter. And that's why, in a way, given how long it takes to arm, to actually turn sort of fine words through spending into actually capability on the ground. That's why we need to be working hard now to ensure that if that situation happens, we look like a tough nut to crack politically and militarily.
We have, as you know, in the US, those who consider themselves restrainers. They don't like the term isolationists. But essentially, they might take from what you just said, okay, so Putin wants a sphere of influence. Kind of can't blame him for that. Just give him the damn sphere of influence and move on. Then we can worry about, you know, Asia and Beijing and Taiwan, and just let him have, you know, stop giving him a hard time. Tell the Ukrainians, I'm sorry, you know, you're just not going to be fully a free nation. You're not going to be part of NATO. By the way, I would argue, and I do all the time because I think it's an important point, it was never a chance that I can recall where Ukraine could join NATO. Hungary wasn't going to vote for it. Germany wasn't going to vote for it. It just wasn't going to happen. So to say that, oh, it was he was threat, or even the whole idea of NATO threatening anybody is sort of kind of funny, because you know, a lot of soldiers from, I don't know, the Netherlands with earrings and stuff, you know, coming across the border. I just don't see it. Anyhow, but then look, this argument is certainly made by these people, restrainers, is stop giving him such a hard time. Give him what he wants, a sphere of influence. We have a sphere of influence. China's probably gonna have a sphere of influence. Just try to contain the sphere of influence and, you know, go home and work on healthcare plans.
Look, I can see the superficial appeal of that, because it does seem actually, yeah, why are we spending all this money when precisely we have all kinds of things that we need to spend money on at home? However, there are, of course, obvious problems. I mean, this is very much the kind of the quote-unquote realist school of thought.
Yes, it is, very much.
Which, I mean, apart from the fact that it's always bugged me because no one really has advanced the unrealistic school of international relations. But realism in this case is just simply used as an excuse for just precisely taking the short-term line of least resistance. The reason why the United States and the West generally has a sphere of influence is, you know, we're not in the 1960s. It's not because of nefarious CIA coups in banana republics or whatever. It's actually because of the power of attraction. It's soft power. The same way as, you know, why did NATO expand? The Russians frame it as kind of imperialist NATO gobbling up countries. It's because countries were hammering at the door saying, we want to join, we want the security, and we want that sense of being part of a democratic security community.
Right.
Which is rather different from how Russia's sphere of influence operates, which is basically, lovely country you've got here, it's a shame if someone trashed your democratic systems. Or indeed the Chinese sphere of influence, which for a long time has been, would you like some money or not? And in many parts of the world, that works really rather well. Though even there, we're beginning to see actually the limitations of that particular model that says we will just simply buy your country and, you know, encourage your kleptocrats. So very, very different spheres. And so if you're more or less saying let Putin have his sphere, apart from the fact that you're obviously betraying all these other countries and their aspirations, and apart from the fact that you're also betraying your own professed moral perspective on foreign policy, but also what you're actually saying is this is a perfectly acceptable model of empire. And that is worrying, because we are heading into a multipolar world, like it or not. The unipolar moment with the collapse of the Soviet Union, I would say, is over. The United States is still undoubtedly the most powerful country in the world. But that is not the same as saying it is the global hegemon. We are seeing not just the rise of China, but, you know, in due course, we're going to see India, we're going to see Brazil, we're going to see South Africa begin to exert in their own regional ways greater influence. And in that respect, we are, I would suggest, at a hinge moment where we are also defining what geopolitics looks like. And if we say that's fine to Putin, I mean, it might well be that we're going to have to write off for the foreseeable future the occupied territories in Ukraine. It's not right, it's not legal, but in practice, that may well be what happens. But there's a difference between saying we need the killing to stop. We want Ukraine to be able to develop, or most of Ukraine to develop, as a sovereign, democratic, stable, West-looking society. And that's not the same as saying, actually, that's what you did, Putin, that was fine. No problem at all. You go ahead and try again if you want. Maybe Kazakhstan is looking a little bit problematic or something. So I think this is it. That's why we can't allow this, is because this is about defining 21st century geopolitics.
Yeah, you know, I think it's not in opposition to what we were saying about Putin's aspirations and his dreams of empire. I think it's complementary. As it happens, I was an official election observer for the last parliamentary elections in 2019. And it was very clear that people were very proud that they had political parties, they had free press, that they were able to conduct free and fair elections. I think Putin looking over the border and saying, that's a terrible example for my people. I do not want that. I think similarly, Xi Jinping doesn't like the fact that Taiwan is a vigorous and democratic society. He wasn't even willing to allow Hong Kong the freedoms that it had for a while. And it would have made sense for him to say to Taiwan, look at Hong Kong, you'll be like that, even if he didn't mean it. But he didn't, I think, because, and people in Taiwan have told me this, because he could, it's part of his point that no, we're going to be authoritarian in any sphere that I have control over. And I think Putin thinks that too. Now, from a Western point of view, the idea that we would just lose a fledgling democratic society is dreadful from the point of view of values. Again, the kind of realist types you talk about, the restrainers would say, don't talk to me about values, talk to me about interests. I don't really care. I object to that, I have to say, personally, but I kind of see their point, except that then what you're doing is shrinking the free world. And, you know, I don't think America wants to be a tangential. You know, the problem with a multipolar world is I'm not sure how sustainable it is with these various poles all being sort of co-equal. I think it's very clear that Xi Jinping sees that as part of a transition to the point where China becomes, under the Communist Party, the world hegemon, the common destiny of mankind, as Xi Jinping would put it. I think you have to understand that it's not like, okay, we can all agree on a multipolar world and all be happy with it, and it's just not going to work out that way. Anyhow, I have more to go on to it. I throw that out to you.
I think it's really interesting. Let me just sort of pick up on two yeah. small points. One is on the China thing. What's interesting to me, and look, I say this not in any way as a China specialist, but you know, one can't help but notice China these days, is precisely the degree to which China is in some ways trying to create alternative structures. You know, its own equivalent of the IMF. Its own equivalent of different trading blocks, its own security block and such like. It's almost like it's trying to create a sort of a shadow set of global institutions, which again, as you say, speaks to this idea that it's not just simply about we have interests in this country, we will try and influence it and assert some degree of control. It's actually precisely about a wider sort of geo-civilizational notion of conflict, in which they happen to feel that China will naturally be the central element, but it's sort of those two things together. The other point about Ukraine as an example, I mean, this is why I often get a lot of flack for my willingness, quote unquote, to write off occupied Ukraine. In that, look, it's not that I think in any way it's right. It's just that I honestly see no theory of victory, whereby at the moment, or with the conceivable level of support that Ukraine could get, it can take these back. I mean, some elements, some areas, sure, but, you know, much of it not. My view is, well, that's just the way it is. But absolutely, my biggest concern is that whenever the guns do go silent, we lose interest. That when we're not watching these heart-wrenching TV scenes of a kindergarten hit by a Shahid drone or whatever, that we think, well, you know, that's sorted. The Ukrainians will work things out and, you know, Europe will send a certain amount of money. But frankly, European politicians, they are facing all kinds of pressures themselves, particularly with rising populism at home, artfully amplified. They're not created by Russia. And they'll actually want to backpedal on their commitments to Ukraine. And I think this would be, on the one hand, the greatest betrayal of Ukraine. Secondly, the greatest gift to Putin, because he wants to be able to tell his people, you see, the Ukrainians fought, and now look at this miserable, failing state that it is. Quite the opposite. The most powerful thing we can do to Putin is ensure that Ukraine succeeds. And ensure that it becomes a model that shows how, because, you know, most Russians, it's a very complex issue, but with some reason, think of Ukrainians as being very much like them, cousins within the same family. And often, to be honest, the slightly backward cousins, again, sure, not endorsing that view, but nonetheless said. Right. And that sort of sense of, if even our backward cousins can now have not just democracy, but prosperity and stability with it, that is a very powerful and corrosive thing, because the one thing that autocrats hate the most is hope. Autocrats thrive on creating hopelessness in their public, more or less saying things can't get any better. Any change is for the worse. So you might as well just hunker down and accept. If they feel there can be positive change, that actually is very dangerous for an autocratic regime, whether it's Putin or Putin's successor.
So hard to argue that Ukrainians aren't brothers or cousins to the Russians, but that's exactly who wars are often fought among cousins or brothers. Arabs and Jews are cousins or brothers for sure. Czechs and Slovaks were one nation for a while. They decided not to be. They decided to do it in a nice way rather than by slaughtering one another. Very Western of them. But that argument that they are from some similar roots, and that's a whole discussion I don't know if I'll have time for, although I'd like to, in terms of Kievan Rus and what that and where those tribes came from. It's very interesting. Doesn't mean that the Ukrainians are not and do not believe themselves to be with justification a people with their own language, with their own culture, with very bad, who do not want to be ruled by the Kremlin when they could be a democratic society much more aligned with the West and more like Poland and more like Czechia and more like Slovakia. That's a lot of what this is about. But I agree with you in terms of, look, what Putin has conquered, I don't see anytime soon Ukraine getting back. What concerns me is he's saying, well, I just need a little more than that, and then I will agree to some kind of truce or armistice. Let's not talk about it as peace. And I think a lot of people are going to say, well, that makes sense. Just, you know, give them the land and Donbass and it's just the Eastern, it's 20%. What the heck? But, and here's where I want to know if you agree with this. That what he's asking for, as I understand it, I'm not a military analyst, but I know a lot of military analysts, is territory would take him about 4 years and a million casualties to conquer through warfare. This would be great for him to say, look what I've done through diplomacy, how much more I've gotten. And if he gets what's called the fortress belt, the fortified cities along the line of contact, then, yes, you can rebuild fortifications further to the west, but as I understand it, the terrain is not as useful for that, and it's kind of expensive and hard to do. And if Putin can say to his generals and his hardliners, here's what I've gotten out of this, in a few years, maybe after Trump leaves office, maybe before, who knows, they're going to be so much more, the Ukrainians, vulnerable to our penetration. We won't have the kind of difficulties we've been having once we get rid of the fortress belt, and then we will be able to get to Kyiv in 3 days. So here's how I'm setting them up for the kill shot. Do you disagree with that analysis? Am I going too far? Some people I know do disagree with me on this.
I mean, I think the key thing is clearly any kind of deal has to have genuine security guarantees for Ukraine, and a lot of that is going to be about helping Ukraine.
And that's getting harder because Lavrov is saying, the foreign minister is saying, yes, security guarantees, if the British and French want to come in, they're going to stand side by side with Russian and Chinese soldiers. It's not
Yeah, exactly. Though Lavrov these days, the foreign minister, I mean, he has almost physically shrunk so much since 2014. I mean, nowadays, his role is really to be a propagandist. And frankly, often to be these days the bad cop.
Yeah.
Which allows Putin to then make himself sound a little bit more reasonable. I mean, you know, it's hard to know whether or not this is if Putin genuinely thinks that Zelensky can and would give up this territory. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be catastrophic for all the reasons you mentioned, plus one more. In some ways, this is a political dagger at Zelensky's heart. If for whatever reason he's induced or forced or feels he has no option but to give up this territory, territory which is steeped in the blood of thousands of Ukrainian defenders, then it's very hard to think that politically he can survive. Indeed, I honestly wonder, well, I mean, look, this is not saying, but certainly people I know who are in Kyiv and who on the whole are not the sort of oppositionist figures or people likely to sort of peddle the most wild rumors. But some of them have even said, you know, actually, if Zelensky gave those orders, I'm not entirely sure that the military chain of command would hold and that people would obey. So given that from Putin's point of view, this is not just about a triumph that he can sell to Russians. This is why all these deaths were worthwhile. It's also about ensuring that Ukraine becomes as ungovernable, as miserable, and as divided a state as possible for subsequent political and economic pressure. Then, you know, this just seems to offer him everything, which is one of the reasons why I just cannot see it being tenable.
But if my fear is, Zelensky says, we're not giving up anything de jure, not recognized.
Yeah.
Anyway, de facto, we understand they've got some of our territory, and, you know, we'll take the ceasefire for the reason that then we can start to build up our military, become a steel porcupine, as they say, so it's harder for a predator to digest us. Because at the end of the day, the only security guarantee that really matters is what the Ukrainians are able to do to defend themselves.
Yes,
Putin will rearm as well. But, you know, that's an arms race, essentially. And meanwhile, the Ukrainians get training in a way that they are only sort of getting now. In other words, we have retired military officers going over there, training them in combined arms maneuvers, but no active duty. But that could be if you had an armistice, and that would be important to do. What I do worry about is that if, say, Trump doesn't understand the kind of thing I've just talked about in terms of the fortress belt and thinks, you know what, I really do want to get a truce here, you know, recognize, and he says to Zelensky, there's not going to be any sanctions, and you're not going to get any more arms from me. Here's what you got to do. You've got to de facto accept that. Then he's in pretty bad trouble, and the Ukrainians are. I don't know what happens at that point. Maybe Putin does overrun more of the country, although, and even in that case, I see a dreadful insurgency. I don't see the Ukrainians simply accepting their masters in Moscow. And in that insurgency, I can totally see Putin modeling off the Nazis, saying, if one Russian soldier is killed, we're going to wipe out a village. Now, by the way, if Trump understands that, I'm sure he's somebody also who is thinking about his legacy. And that's not the legacy he wants. The legacy he wants is, I'm a peacemaker. I know how to do this. I can work out deals between peoples who think they hate each other, that are mutual, that are essentially win-win. That may be, you know, there's a difference between win-win in a New York real estate deal and a win-win in geopolitics that goes back centuries. But what I would like to see, what I would certainly say we would be urging and are urging on Trump, is hit Putin economically. There are all kinds of ways to do that. And also keep delivering weapons to the Europeans to transfer to the Ukrainians without restrictions, long-range missiles, offensive weapons to be used against targets, military targets in Russia. And at that point, maybe Putin says, okay, it's time for a pause. I don't think it's more than that. That's sort of our argument at this think tank. Yeah.
I mean, look, I do think that at the moment, I mean, it's easy to say, oh, Putin doesn't believe in peace. He's just stringing Trump along. And he may be. But there are also indications to suggest that he does see a potential window of opportunity. Look, he is under pressure. There's no question. You know, the Russian economy, you know, he's got his own ministers hammering away at him that it's basically sliding into recession. There's all kinds of other pressures. It's clear that Russian hegemony has been lost in the South Caucasus, where both Armenia and Azerbaijan are now making deals with each other rather than sort of
Syria has lost.
Syria's lost, and Central Asia, frankly, is increasingly now looking to China as security guarantor as well as economic partner. So, for all of these reasons, there is pressure. The point is, it's not the kind of pressure which is going to force him to peace. It means that he's willing to explore the prospects of whether he gets a deal that he likes, but he's also perfectly willing to walk away. If he doesn't, because he still believes time is on his side. He doesn't have to fight forever. He doesn't have to fight for 4 years. If he could just fight longer than Ukraine can. And Ukraine does have problems, serious problems as well, not least in terms of manpower. Now, so I think, you know, this is a very complex issue. The interesting thing is you threw in, just mentioned it, the role of Europe, which again, I think is becoming more salient. And I get, look, I mean, it's a slightly sort of odd position being a sort of Brit, in that Britain is now in Europe, but not of Europe and such like. And there is a strange kind of bipolarity about Europe at the moment. On the one hand, there is this bullish, we don't need the Americans, we've got the money, we can build up our own forces, if need be, we can step in to support Ukraine as it needs. And on the other one, what are we going to do without daddy? And I think it does reflect the fact that Europe willfully infantilized itself for decades, yes, not being willing to actually deal with its own security, but essentially happy to outsource it to the United States for so long. And now they're coming to terms with the consequences of that, which isn't just about who guards you in a war, but do you have, for example, the defensive productive capacities? Having to rebuild factories or build factories from scratch to actually have your own capacity, rather than just thinking, well, if need be, we just buy it off the Americans or whoever. So I think that there is a real question here. And you talk about what happens to Zelensky, if Zelensky's put in that position. Well, he can fight on because he can, Ukrainians can just simply choose to fight on, however unfortunate their position. And the Europeans can fill some of the gap left by a full withdrawal of US capability. Not all of it. Things like the intelligence, which is being provided behind the scene. No one has got that. I mean, yes, GCHQ is pretty good, but it's not the NSA. A lot of the targeting for these long-range strikes depends entirely on American intelligence. I was talking to someone from the UK Ministry of Defense who very much follows these long-range missile and drone strikes that the Ukrainians have been launching very successfully against particularly Russian energy infrastructure, who reckon that basically 50% of those strikes depend entirely on American targeting information. And without that, well, look, everyone's got Google Maps. Factories don't move around. But in order to be pretty sure of hitting, the Ukrainians will probably have to use three times as many missiles or drones for each strike than they are now. So they could still launch long-range strikes, but they'd be able to launch far fewer because they'll be having to launch many more. So it's things like that that, unfortunately, at the moment, no one else can pick up the slack. And that's why it really is important that, if need be, the Ukrainians can fight on, but the point is they will fight on hampered if they do so with a full withdrawal of American assistance.
I do want to be respectful of your time, but I must ask you this. How do you see, is Zelensky holding up well, as best you can tell? This is an unbelievable strain for a guy who a few years ago was the star of a situation comedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary how wars make or break people. Just before the invasion, Zelensky was, his ratings were plummeting. There was this sense that he precisely just was not up to the job. And then he came along and in part precisely because of his capacity to be a performer. And I mean that in a positive sense, ranging from his entirely sort of memeable, "I need ammunition, not a ride" comment when the Americans offered to airlift him out, to his regular sort of engagements with the Ukrainian people. I mean, in some ways, most effectively of all, his willingness to be not just Ukraine's ambassador abroad, but to break all the diplomatic rules. This is a man who's not afraid to lambast and attack when he feels that people are not pulling their weight in supporting Ukraine. And, I know from experience of talking to a variety of different sort of ambassadors and other foreign service personnel, I mean, it can sometimes not just astonish them, but terrify them, because they're used to everyone following certain diplomatic rules. And Zelensky won't. I think that we are seeing, and this has been inevitable, we are seeing some of the limitations of his system, which is, again, actually very personalistic. He depends very, very heavily on his chief of staff, Andriy Yermak. There is concern, for example, about corruption, that oligarchic corruption might well get, in some ways, being supplanted by administrative corruption from around the center. Because, to a degree, all states, when they're in total war, they become socialist authoritarianisms, in the sense of ultimately all power to the center. If you need to be able to do something, you do it. And that's understandable because this is a genuine existential struggle for Ukraine. The question is, what happens after? I mean, I do wonder if in some ways as and when, I mean, I don't think there's going to be sort of imminent elections, but nonetheless, there clearly are maneuverings going on. And particularly here in, you know, in the UK, the ambassador to the UK, the Ukrainian ambassador to the UK, General Zaluzhny, was more or less sent here in exile, precisely because he was just getting a bit too popular and there was only room for one star in the heavens. Well, there are these recurring suggestions that he's preparing a team. He's, you know, he's not pushing, but nonetheless, as and when there will be elections, that he's in a position that he can decide whether he chooses to stand or not. I do wonder if Zelensky will find himself being a little bit like Winston Churchill, this extraordinary war leader who is revered for what he does in the war. But at the end of the war, his people think, we think you're great, we're going to put statues up to your name, but we think it's time for someone else to build the peace. But at the moment, I mean, there is to be, I mean, obviously there are other figures around, but so many of them are frankly compromised by, well, unkind souls would say corruption. I would just simply say non-traditional means of enrichment, or else, you know, past regimes or whatever. I mean, I don't think at the moment there is anyone who can really replace him. He is in this respect, you know, as crucial a war resource as any.
I can't resist. I'm reminded that when Churchill lost power after the war, I believe Clementine said to him, you know, perhaps this is a blessing in disguise. And he responded, well, it's well disguised then, isn't it? I've never gotten to the news, but I'll just mention we're recording this on Thursday, the 28th of August. And overnight, at least 17, the last report I saw, over 17 people, or at least 17 people were killed, including three children and dozens more injured in a fierce barrage. The second largest barrage on Kyiv since the war began. It even damaged the European Union's delegation's offices in Kyiv. It was the largest attack since the Trump-Putin summit in Alaska. And I think it is going to be hard for Trump not to see this as a commentary on that summit, which I think it was. I would hope that Melania is saying to him, you see, I told you so, because I think she understands Eastern Europe rather well, having been born in what was Yugoslavia, which, again, cousins who couldn't get along at the end of the day in one South Slavic republic. And also Putin right now is packing his bags to attend the Shanghai Security Conference. And he's supposed to stay. He'll be the guest of honor. And he's going to stay longer than the other 20-plus Asian leaders. As China showcases its military might in a parade marking the end of World War II. These things, I do hope that President Trump's advisors, such as they are saying to him, let's think about what all this means. Let's think about the no limits partnership between Putin and the most powerful communist party in history. The Cold War may not be over, or maybe it's in 2.0. So, I'll say one more thing. I'll let you comment on that if you want to, and then I'll ask you one more thing about your work, and I'll let you go because it's only fair.
Sure. Well, let me just raise on, you talked about these strikes on Kyiv. I mean, for me, this is exactly Putin's style of negotiation. This is why he's rejected the idea of a ceasefire before talks. His view is it's war and peace. It's that he wants to keep the Ukrainians under pressure. So he's more or less saying, you know, you can make a deal with me today, or you can make a deal with me after I've pummeled you for another week or a month or a year. But also what was really striking was two of the missiles that hit Kyiv, as you say, hit the bloc, which includes the European Union delegation and also the British Council offices. Mm. British Council, which was basically declared persona non grata, shall we say, or organization non grata in Russia back in June because they claimed that it was a den of British espionage and subversion. And again, to me, that was very, very clearly a message, because these were, I mean, they're either Iskander or KH-102 cruise missiles. Accurate things. The fact that you had two of these hitting within 20 seconds of each of the other on this block means this was not just a kind of a random strike.
Right.
And I think very much this is also a kind of a warning to London and to Brussels, saying basically, don't get in the way. Don't get all these fancy ideas about coalition of the willing peacekeepers in Ukraine or whatever. Now, this is Putin's style of negotiation.
And makes it much more difficult to come up with a serious security guarantee, even if you came up with some kind of deal for an armistice in terms of land. I mean, it makes the whole thing, I think it's, makes it very unlikely we're going to see a resolution to this war soon, I think.
Sadly so, yes.
You began your podcast when? 2020, do I recall? Is that right?
It's something like that, yes. Back in what for me feels like the dim and distant past.
And the title, In Moscow's Shadows, what should we infer from that?
Well, I mean, look, it's in part because I do have this thoroughly discreditable interest in criminality and corruption and so forth. And, you know, one of the reasons, because I should throw in an entirely gratuitous plug, my most recent book, Homo Criminalis,
yes,
which is essentially a kind of an organized crime history of the world. It's not just about Russia, it's about everywhere. So everything
is it out yet, by the way? Is it available?
It's out in the UK. It's out, I think, in about a month or so's time, technically in the United States. So you can buy it on, I think. Maybe
we will buy a copy and we will have you back on to talk about that if you like. Because it's global criminality, right? Because we're only, maybe we don't.
Absolutely. But
fascinating.
But for me, one of the reasons why I'm interested in crime is because I'm interested in the gap between how societies are meant to operate and how they do, really. Because it's that gap that, for example, the gangsters colonize. And it's also that gap in which you find the populists arise, the terrorists, the subversives of all kinds. And, you know, particularly, you know, a lot of my sort of work on Russia has been about the security services, the intelligence activities, as I say, corruption, murder, all of these things, which, as I say terrible, terrible things about my character, but more or less sort of give a sense of the particular angle. Now, to a degree, this, like everything else, has been hijacked by this ghastly war in Ukraine, in that often there are sort of things I want to talk about one week, but then, no, I need to comment on the latest peace talks or whatever else. But still, my particular interest, you know, I'm not a quant political scientist. I don't deal in big data sets. But on the other hand, you know, especially in those days when I could do so in Moscow, sitting down with some alcohol and, you know, talking to a couple of, security service officers or whatever, that was my jam.
And so In Moscow's Shadows is the shadows Moscow is casting on the world, in a sense.
You name it. Just okay. One way or the other, Moscow's got a hell of a lot of shadows.
Well, so look, I look forward to talking to you again. I look forward to sitting down, perhaps in Washington, with a great deal of alcohol, much better than the vodka you get either. Although Ukrainian vodka is not so bad. I particularly like the kind that is both has a little bit of honey and a little bit of pepper. You know, that there's one, and that's just very hard to get in the U.S., that particular type.
Well, there you go. They have an export opportunity already.
for sure. Mark Eliade, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been an education, and it's been just a pleasure. Hope to do it again. And so thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my very great pleasure. Look forward to next time.
And thanks to all of you who have been with us for this conversation today here on Foreign Policy. Thank you for listening to this episode of Foreign Policy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us, preferably with 5 stars. Ratings and reviews help give us visibility and the opportunity to reach more people who seek to understand the most critical national security and foreign policy issues. Also, make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow FDD on social media and visit our website at fdd.org. There you can find research by FDD experts, you can subscribe to all FDD's products, you can catch up on any past episodes you may have missed. Finally, we'd love your feedback, your ideas, your questions, your criticisms. Send us an email at foreignpodicy@fdd.org. Until next time, I'm Cliff May, and you've been listening to Foreign Podicy.